Welcome everyone to the session this evening, and if you're in the back row and you don't want to be in the back row, you can move forward so you don't leave Werner up here all by himself. It is kind of a big room. Yes, good choice. Anyway, okay, make him talk loud. You're being mean. Okay. Move forward, people, unless you have to see. Please, I'm serious.
You don't have to. I like to sit in the back, too.
Yeah, I know you do, but it's hard to hear and it's hard to talk loud when you're in this room. Werner was involved with Holden Village from the very beginning, 1961 on. In 1963, he took on a role, maybe they even officially gave you a title at that point, business manager. But Scott's... Slaba is our current business manager, and Werner's job description as business manager, I think we're slightly different. Scott has to focus on business and numbers, and Werner focused on that, plus anything that happened in this valley, it felt like. So he's got wonderful stories from 20 years of living in this valley with his family from 1963 to 1983, and we're really happy to have him back and share those stories. And I have reminded people that are here during this remediation time, all of you, that this is a weird time, just like the beginning at Holden Village was weird. And now Werner is coming to tell us those fun, weird stories. You are going to be someday, Werner's weird, and so are you, dear Daryl. But yes, We in this room are, I'm sure, going to come back to Holden at some point and tell stories about this crazy time at Holden Village. And so take good notes, take pictures. If you don't have this unbelievable memory like Werner does, you're going to need to take notes and journals and pictures, because he seems to remember everything, and it's really fun. So I have some questions ready for him, but he's on a roll, and he'll start off with some good stories. So welcome, Werner.
I think very few of you, if any of you, were here at the beginning, so, I mean, it's not. It may not be true that I'm telling you the truth, so, but you wouldn't know it, so that's why we call them stories. But I think most of it is the truth. But I think Stephanie makes a good point that, you know, especially in this day and age, and I think especially with Holden, that people need to write their stories, because so many people have been involved in Holden from the beginning that have been forgotten, basically. And every single one that comes up here is a part of the community and creates, you know, helps change the community and helps develop the community. And I guess that was one reason, well, I really wrote my memoirs. At least I say it's for our children, Christy and Jeff, so that they remember, you know, their roots. Our daughter was here for 13 years, and our son was here for 10 years during the time we were here. And they have very pleasant memories, but of course a lot of what they remember as children is different than what actually took place. And so it's, but I think, you know, and again, now, like I if I ever publish my memoirs, it'll probably be through Amazon, which, you know, they have a great system. Some people don't like Amazon. I happen to like them. And they have a self-publishing business, which is part of their operation. And so anybody can print a book nowadays. And you don't have to, pre-publish 1,000 copies to get a good price, because you send a manuscript to Amazon, and I mean, you can even pay them for doing editing if you want, and cover design, or you can just send them a manuscript and they'll put it out as an ebook. They'll put it out as a, you know, if somebody orders a copy, a hard copy, they print it, you know, instantaneously, so they don't have to do 1,000 copies. So it's really a marvelous time to, if you ever want to write your stories, and put them out on Amazon. It doesn't cost anything except, you know, your time. And I think especially with Holden and with other operations like this. I mean, if you belong to an organization like the Washington Trails, you know, somebody's written a book about that too, but they should, because every organization has, you know, a unique story, And in this day and age, not, I mean, Amazon isn't the only one that does self-publishing, but they're just one that I know of that makes it very easy to do. But, I mean, the one thing that I guess I wanted to start out with tonight, I think the bulletin board said it would be on innovation in the Valley, and I'll get to that too. I did some of that last night. And but one of the great things, and I think it's still going on today, but in the beginning, Holden became an arena for especially young adults that were just going into college or in college. And I don't know, you know, I mean, as a mature person or an old person, I guess, is a you know, you always look back and think that it was different then. It probably isn't different from now, but in the church and in society, it seemed like there were so many people questioning, you know, what's going on in life, you know, and it was the beginning of the 60s was the hippie revolution, and a lot of things were changing. People were questioning what was going on in society. The Vietnam War was, you know, getting started. You know, the peace movement was getting started. You know, all of those things. And Holden provided, in a very real sense, a safe place for a lot of young adults to come and speak their mind or to have their ideas challenged. And it was a marvelous thing to watch that, you know, I was 24 when I started up here, so a lot of the people that we brought in as volunteers, or, you know, there were a lot of people on the staff that were much older than I was. And but it was great to see that in a place like this, with under the direction of, you know, great faculty members from, you know, college and universities, that young people could come here and struggle with their ideas and even, you know, claim they didn't believe in God and you know, argue with the professors and so forth, and, you know, and nobody criticized them. I think that's one reason why Holden was so important for a lot of young adults, is that, you know, in their home, you know, maybe their parents were mad at them. In fact, I would get letters from college professors or seminary professors and begging us to take their son or daughter up here because they figured that their son or daughter was losing their faith, or they were, you know, splitting off from the family, and they didn't, they were scared. The parents were scared, and they said, please take our son or daughter and see if you can straighten them out. And we didn't have a program of straightening them out, but it was a safe place for people to come, whether they were young or older, and they could struggle with their thoughts, with their faith, with their ideas. Again, nobody criticized them. It was a safe place. Even the group home, I mentioned that last night, that we had the group home for six boys. And the only thing that I ever saw that we provided for them, again, was a safe place. Because, you know, when they lived in Wenatchee or Chelan or wherever they came from, since they were bad boys, I mean, they were listed as bad boys, the patrolmen were always at their doorstep. Anything happened in the city, they were the ones that, you know, got questioned. Here, they could be just young boys, and nobody was, I mean, everybody was concerned about them, but there was no, you know, there was no sheriff here. And we, in fact, one boy that was, he had a real problems with thievery, we started noticing in the store that boxes of things were missing. And we finally discovered that, you know, this particular boy easily got into the locked store, and he would take boxes of shampoo to his room or boxes of batteries. I mean, things that he didn't need, but it was just part of who he was. And, you know, we'd go over once in a while, and we knew he had them, and he admitted it, and he brought them back. But no, I mean, we didn't have a jail here. It was hard to discipline the boys because everybody was doing everything. We couldn't say, well, you were bad today, so you do dishes, because all of us were doing dishes, or we were all splitting wood, or we were all, you know, doing the thing. So it was a safe place for, you know, a lot of people to come in those days and struggle with their basically existence and try to find some direction for their life. The other thing that was, I think, really significant was the intergenerational activities or the society that, that took place up here. And we didn't, you know, we didn't think about it ahead of time, but we had, you know, we didn't plan to have retired people here and young adults here. It just happened because those were the two groups that had the time available to come up here for nothing. And but we discovered that that the young people were oftentimes looking for a grandparent and maybe never had a grandparent that they could relate to, or the elderly or the retired person was, you know, was grieving because they didn't have a grandson or granddaughter. And we saw this melding of generations where, you know, surrogate grandparents and surrogate grandsons and daughters, you know, were existing and you know, meaningful relationship. I even had an experience with our son Jeff, who was maybe at that time 4 years old, and Omer Klein was one of our volunteers. He had been in the corporate world for many years and gone through a divorce, and he had no knowledge of Holden, but somebody suggested he come up here, and he came up, and basically Holden was his home for a couple of years. And for some reason, our son Jeff and Omer just bonded. Like, you know, I mean, I actually was jealous because, you know, every night after dinner, Jeff would run over and jump up into Omer's lap and sit there, and then they would go up into his room, and Omer had a box of little toys and wires and bolts and nuts, and they would sit there, and Jeff would play with these things. And, you know, I really thought, you know, that's the kind of relationship I want with my son, and why isn't he coming and sitting on my lap? And and then all of a sudden I discovered that Jeff didn't have a grandfather and Omer didn't have a grandson. And so that it was a revelation to me that it was such a beautiful thing to see. So for, you know, basically 2 years, you know, our son Jeff had a grandfather. And Omer had a grandson, and this is the type of thing that happens in the community, and you don't plan for it; it just happens. But you celebrate it when it does happen. And you know, a lot of young adults that came up here, and not sometimes, you know, college age and so forth, and then they would decide they wanted to go into the ministry. And I always considered myself a very poor counselor, because if somebody came to me and had a problem, you know, the answer was obvious, and I'd just say, well, it's obvious, and you need to do this, rather than work with them. I mean, I'm not a trained counselor. But I would sit with a lot of people that would want to know, you know, that they're thinking about going into the ministry, and I would tell them, you know, I don't think you ought to do that. We, you know, there's enough people going to the ministry. We need good people to go into the various activities in the United, or in the corporate world, or in school, or whatever, and be good pew sitters, because the church, you know, can't exist with only pastors. It needs people out there to, you know, to do the normal things. My father was a pastor, so I'm not criticizing pastors. It's, but I think that was, in a sense, one of the dangers of Holden, is that it encouraged some people, and they thought they had to be more religious because of what they saw here, rather than they just needed to be good carpenters, or they needed to be good farmers, or whatever their profession might be. And so, you know, this is, I think, was part of, and I'm sure it still is, part of what Holden is for many people. But now to get back to sort of the innovation, I think last night I started talking about the Jerusalem artichoke problem, or I mean the project up on the tailings, and I didn't mention that we actually had Jerusalem artichokes growing up there, about 8 feet tall, for a whole summer, and they were doing beautifully. And we just happened to think of this project when the university, or Washington State University, was doing a research project on Jerusalem artichokes, because it turns out, you know, in eastern Washington around Moses Lake, they used to have a lot of sugar beets, and that disappeared for some reason. I'm not sure why, but they were looking at Jerusalem artichokes as a substitute for sugar beets, because you can actually get more sugar per acre out of Jerusalem artichokes than you can out of sugar beets, and it's the type of sugar that diabetics can deal with. And Jerusalem artichokes don't have a lot of the disease problems that some other agricultural products do, and the bugs don't bother them. So, I mean, to me, it always seemed like they were the ideal crop, and yet they've never really taken hold in the agricultural world for some reason. So there must be a reason. Probably they can't make as much money or something of them. I'm not sure. But they were doing this research project, and we contacted our friends over at WSU, and they said that they have 800 tubers, 800 Jerusalem artichoke tubers, and if we would come to the Prosser Research Station and pick them up, we could have them. So we sent a truck over there and picked them up and planted them on the tailings and irrigated them with, you know, with the effluent from our sewage system, and they were growing 8 feet tall. And we even planted some tomatoes up there. Since the artichokes were doing so well, we thought, well, maybe some other products would do well. And we had great tomatoes growing up there. We didn't eat them, and we didn't serve them in the dining hall. but as part of this, there was the head of the Weyerhaeuser Laboratories in south of Seattle was up here with his family visiting, and I happened to get acquainted with him, and I said, is there any chance that we could send some tomatoes and artichokes with you, and you could do a test in your laboratory to see if there is any reason why, you know, these products couldn't be consumed, you know, like, you know, for personal consumption. And he said, well, you know, I can't officially give you a report on it, but he says, I'm willing to take these products with me and test them, and I'll send you a letter. So he did, and he said, you know, he didn't find any bacteria, he didn't find any chemicals, he didn't find anything that would be negative to, you know, for consumption. But again, I guarantee you, we didn't serve anything in the dining hall that we grew on the tailings with sewage. But it was one of those projects. But the you know, sometimes I think Holden over the years has thought that we've been so innovative up here, and you know, we forget that there was a mine that was here before we were, and the mine was exceedingly innovative. Before Google, I was in the Seattle Library, and I did a literature research on the Holden Mine, and you know, which was more difficult than Google. But there was a number of national mine magazines that they carried, and it was amazing that one particular year, I think it was in some of the early years of the mine started in 37, and this was probably in 42, that in the national mine magazines, there were 11 of the 12 months there were articles on Holden Village in this national magazine on innovations that were taking place up here with innovating hard rock mining techniques, safety techniques. One of the buildings that is no longer there was called the dry room. And since the mine was very moist and wet, that the miners would come out, you know, after a day's work underground, and they would go to the dry room, and they would get into their, or before they got into their civilian clothes, they would hang their wet clothes in sort of lockers that were heated, so that the next day then they were dry and usable. But they also had, I guess we would call it a Lazy Susan, and it was a big, I don't know, I mean it was probably about the size of this platform here. And there were sections where you could just lay down on it, and it was, they had sun lamps, so that, because again, people that worked underground in the mine got no sun, and so that the vitamin D was a problem, and they had a system where you make one round with this rotating, you know, sort of bed, and then you would get a day's supply of vitamin D. I mean, they did some things that were very innovative for those days, and they really cared for the workers. So, you know, many things that they did up there were perfected here at the Holden Mine. And so, and even before the Holden Mine, the mine probably thought they were very innovative, and maybe that, but they forgot that there was an Oscar Getty who, down at Lucerne, I don't know if you've noticed, they have 3 acres where the Lake Chelan Boat Company has facilities, and it really belongs to the Getty estate now. Oscar is no longer living. But he came up here in, I think it was 1919 or something, and he ended up with that property from a patented mining claim. I mean, they never mined down there, but in you know, the government has very easy mining regulations. I can't remember, 1897 or something like that, the mining laws of 1897, that made it very easy for prospectors to take a stake of land, and they only have to do a certain amount of improvement a year, and they could actually end up with patented land so that they owned the land. And so Oscar ended up with this 3 acres, which is tremendously valuable from 25 Mile Creek up to Stehekin. That's the only piece of private land there is on the lake. And he started his little business down there, but he was a packer, and the only packer in the valley. And so there was a mine up at Crown Point Falls, which if you've hiked up in that direction, right at the base of Lyman Lake is Crown Point Falls, and there was a molybdenum mine up there. And at least the stories, some of the stories Oscar told me, and then some of them I've just heard, but he hauled all the original equipment by horseback up to the Crown Point mines. And then he was also a packer for tourists that wanted to go up to Lyman Lake. Again, the stories have been corroborated by some people that supposedly were on these trips, but they sounded sort of far-fetched for me. But he would take like 2 week trips up to Lyman Lakes with the people that wanted to go up there and stay for a period of time. And he took a cow and chickens, and he did all the cooking, and he took all the food, and his famous thing was glacier ice cream. And at that time, Lyman Glacier, which I think now has disappeared, is it still there? Must not be very much left of it. So, but at that, and this is again the stories that were told. But he had the fresh milk from the cow and the eggs from the chickens, and then he would go to the glacier and chip off ice to make his ice cream. And this was one of his specialties that people, you know, talked about, you know, forever. And it sounds far-fetched, but I've actually talked to people who either went up with him or relatives went up, and they claimed it was true. But, the innovation in the valley has started a long time before even the Holden Mine was here. And there was another individual that was at Donkey Lake for many years. His name was Gordon Stewart. And he worked for the Forest Service for a long time until the Forest Service, and I'm not sure what years this was, they started saying that, you know, if you're going to be a ranger, you have to have a college education. And Gordon didn't have a college education. He had a hair lip, so that he was sort of shy with some. I mean, if you didn't know him well, you would think he was unfriendly, but he was just shy. And he went up to, after he left the ranger station at Lucerne, because they were changing the rules with the Forest Service, he went up and stayed at Domke Lake and lived there for 40 years. And, you know, a lot of people thought he was a hermit and unfriendly, but he was the greatest individual once you got acquainted with him. And he had a wonderful business up there with two cabins that he built, and he had a, you know, business. He had rowboats, and later on he had small outboard motors for fishing, and that was his business. And he did a marvelous business up there. And it was funny, because you would think somebody that lives at Domke Lake, first of all, wouldn't be very well read, but he got the Wall Street Journal, you know, every week. He got, I think, two or three magazines, and you would have marvelous conversations. He was very conservative in his politics, because one of the reasons was that the only radio station he could get up there was KPQ out of Wenatchee, which, you know, has Rush Limbaugh, and I mean, at that time, I don't think Rush Limbaugh was on the air, but was a very conservative radio station. So it was always hard to talk politics with him, because at least for me, because I wasn't known as a conservative. but he ended up with one of his best friends was a stockbroker from Wenatchee that would come up. He would fly his plane up and go fishing, and got acquainted with Gordon. So he advised Gordon on investments, and Gordon, you know, ended up, not a millionaire, I don't think, but he ended up a very, very comfortably, and he didn't have much expenditures except you know, buying gas for the outboard motors and so forth. And we always laughed because in the spring of the year, about March, before the lake thawed out, he would have an annual trip to Las Vegas. And you'd see him get all dressed up with a hat and, you know, a sport jacket. I mean, otherwise it was shabby clothes, you know, that he wore. And he says, I bought enough money for a round-trip ticket and a little bit to gamble. I know I got the round-trip ticket so I could get home, and that's all I care about. And, you know, you wouldn't see him for a week or two, and then he would come back and he would operate his business. Oscar Getty down at the lake, the one that was a packer, when the mine closed down, he had cabins down that he rented, and some of the miners actually lived down there, and he rented them cabins and so forth. And so when the mine closed down, that business disappeared. But he started buying land, and he wouldn't go and look at the land. He would get the Wenatchee paper and look at the sheriff's sales, and he would just read the description in the sheriff's sales, and he would send a bid. You know, for some land, and you know, a lot of times that he didn't get the land, but he was telling me one time that he bought a piece of land further east, I think over by Conconelli or someplace over east of here, and it sounded interesting, but it happened to be below a BLM recreation dam, and it was, I don't know, it was 10 acres or something like this, and wouldn't you know it, the dam leaked. And went on his property, and the government had to pay him big bucks for it. You know, so he ended up with, and this was, it always seemed like he would end up, you know, just lucking into some of these land deals. And again, he, you know, he was always wearing, you know, old clothes, but he never lacked for anything. One time, we waited down in his little house down there sometimes in the wintertime for the boat to come in, and because you know, we'd always go down and wait for the boat, and there would be maybe half an hour when we drove down with the snowmobile. And I was down there one time, and he had his old coat on. It was sort of threadbare, and he said, it's about time for the boat to come in. And he took off his old coat, no, he took off his new coat and put on his old coat and walked out to the boat. And I said, Gordon, you know what, why did you do that? Why didn't you wear your good coat down there? He said, oh, the tourists like to take pictures of mountain guys, and so and he was the greatest. I mean, those two guys were the jewels of the valley, and they were here before the Holden mine, and they were here before, you know, anybody came. And you know, I often thought, you know, I believe that God created the world, and I believe that God created Oscar and Gordon, but God probably had a real chuckle watching Gordon and Oscar, you know, live. And I believe that God gave, you know, started creation, but then he let creation take over and do by itself what it did. And I think Oscar and Gordon were two of the really prized people that God probably says, I'm not sure if this was a good idea, but and Gordon up at Domke Lake was the only one that ever, at least I heard, ever made any comments about what was going on up here at Holden. Oscar was always, I mean, he didn't say much, but Gordon every once in a while would say, you know, I just don't understand, you know, what the Lutherans are doing up there. You know, and but he I think he loved the place. And later in life, when he was getting up in age and couldn't always go over to take care of his cabins, because the two cabins he had was on the other side of the lake, so he'd have to row over there. And they were great cabins that when you rented a cabin, you always had flannel sheets, and the wood was always cut. And so he talked to me one time, and he said, you have a lot of girls up there that volunteer, don't you? I said, yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of staff. And he said, well, I'd like to hire one. And I thought, you know, is he a dirty old man, or is that what's going on here? But it was over the years, and I don't know how many, I think it was probably 15 or 20 girls that he hired. You know, I mean, they were just one at a time that lived there and did the sort of the housekeeping for him. When he died, he in his will, he had a gift for each one of these girls that had In fact, they're right now, when I came up on Monday, four of them were coming up for a reunion of the, they called them the Gordon Girls. And I had heard stories about that in his will that he left money for these, you know, the people that had worked for him. And I asked one of them, you know, because I said that I'd heard that it was like $10,000 that he left each one. And it turned out to be more than that, probably closer to $16,000. So, you know, he was a unique individual and a wonderful person. And in some ways, he was responsible for Holden even getting started, the mine. Because when he was a ranger at Lucerne, there was the... Mr. Barquest, William Barquest, was the exploration engineer up here for the Howsine Mine Company in 1921 to, I think he then left just shortly before it went into production, or 1929. And there was a forest fire that burned off Copper Basin, and it was, you know, burned off the basically all the trees in the basin. The Forest Service was coming up here to present a bill to the Howsine Company for the cost of that fire, and it was a $50,000 bill, and they were riding up. At that time, there was the trail was actually on the south side. I mean, yeah, the south side of the valley. And Gordon, since he was the Forest Service representative at Lucerne, was bringing up. They came up on horseback, and they rode through the fire. And Gordon. And this is the story that Barquist told me. He said that Gordon noticed that one of the trees had been hit by lightning, and it was evident that the fire was started by lightning rather than from the mine, because they had just assumed that the mine had started the fire. And Gordon pointed this out to the forest supervisor who was coming up. And so they came down to the office where Barquist was working, and the forest supervisor, according to Barquist, and tore the bill in half and said, you know, this is how close you came to getting a $50,000 bill for the fire suppression, but we discovered it was lightning rather than the mine. And Barquest told me, he said that if they would have not discovered that, that Howsine would have pulled out, because all the figures that they had, it was going to be a marginal business as far as the mine is concerned. It would you know, it wouldn't be a lucrative mine, but it would be, they would make money off of it, but not a lot. And if they had another $50,000 bill, he said they would have pulled out. So, you know, in a sense, I credit Gordon Stewart for, you know, actually allowing Howsine to be here, which made Holden, you know, I mean, we then had the facility after Howsine. So this, again, is you know, just how people in the community and people like Gordon Stewart and Oscar Getty, you know, were so much a part of the valley and so much a part of Howsine and so much a part of Holden. So, you know, Holden has a lot to be thankful for, and it's more than, you know, what we have done here and what other people have done here, but it's also, you know, Gordon and Oscar who are gone now, and wonderful people that they were. But one of the first needs that Holden had when we came up here was electricity, and I think I mentioned last night we started out with two diesel generators, and they were installed in 1961, and then Gil Berg, who was the first volunteer manager and director of Holden, he owned Berg Fuel in Ballard, and he was close to retirement age, so his son-in-law was sort of running the business, but it was a, you know, home delivery fuel oil business and a very lucrative one. And he was also the president of Lutheran Bible Institute, who, you know, initially was given Holden. And Gil, let's see, I guess I lost my train of thought. What was I saying?
Diesel generators.
Oh yeah. but what Gil said was that he first got a group of people together. He called them the Development Council, and it was a group of men that he got acquainted with from basically Washington State. I think all of them were with Washington State, but there was a fellow from Kennewick that was had worked with large construction all over the world, putting up, you know, huge steel mills and plants and even hydro plants and so forth. And there was another fellow that worked for NC Machinery in Seattle that dealt with, you know, Caterpillar equipment, and he specialized in generators, and that's how the diesel generators got here, that he found NC Machinery had just gotten two used generators from a fishing village in Alaska, and they reconditioned them, and then those are the ones that are still sitting down here. And I think they are each 50 kilowatts, and if I remember right, they paid $7,500 a piece for each one of those. But anyway, Gil brought this, what he called the Development Council, together, and one of the first sort of assignments was, they were all volunteers, he said, we've got to figure out a way to have electricity up here that we can afford, and the diesel generators are going to be just a temporary fix for this. And so they started looking for, you know, some hydro plants. And, you know, they're not generally a shelf item, you know, you don't do well in the store. A farmer, a big rancher in Wilbur, Washington, between here and Spokane, they had huge wheat holdings around Wilbur and also in Montana, and they heard, or they found, these units in Idaho. They were sitting in a warehouse. They had been sitting for 20 years, and they were part of an irrigation project over there originally. And they bought them for $1,500. All the equipment, the two generators, the governors, the control panels, they got for $1,500, and then they gave it to Holden. They brought it, they paid for the transportation, they brought it with their equipment over to the lake, and they helped get it up here. And so, you know, they were marvelous, generous people that, you know, found these things. And then, of course, the units really weren't usable because there had been rat damage to the windings, and, you know, some things were missing, but basically they were there, you know. So that started the hydro project. And then the first thing that went on was, you know, building a foundation for these units, because they're heavy units, and they're designed for a head of 640 feet, so that's a lot of pressure. I think it's 42,000 pounds pressure that is at the nozzles, and I think that's what it was. So the foundation had to be really good, and the only thing that we had up here at the time was, I think they call them half-sack mixer. They're using one up behind where I don't know what they're building up there, but I saw them using one, and I'm sure it's not the same one, but... it might be, but that's what was used for, you know, and the foundation for those units was huge, and a lot of concrete was poured in there, and it was all mixed with this, you know, half-sack mixer, and all the aggregate was hand-sifted. A lot of it came from a little... it wasn't a quarry, but it was right along the creek between here and the ball field down. Yeah. There's an area we hauled that with a small vehicle, and I mean it's almost impossible to imagine that, you know, that the hydro plant could have been built that way, but it was. I mean, it just took a long time to do it, and then the first phase of the hydro plant was that. A 14-inch pipe was put in. It's 14-inch steel wrapped pipe with dresser couplings, and it was put from the hydro plant up to I guess the old water tank isn't there anymore. I don't know what is there, but we call it the old water tank. It was sort of at the top of the hill by the upper mine level, which may not be there either. Everything's changed. But anyway, so the first 900 feet of pipe was put in, and the mine had a diversion dam. On Copper Creek, and the pipe, there was wood stave pipe, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was wonderful cedar wood stave pipe. Very easy to, you know, if you got a leak in it, you just took a cedar shingle and tapped it in the hole, and then it expanded, and then it solved the leak. So, I mean, it was very easy to to deal with. And anyway, the Woodstave pipe came down from the diversion dam to the water tank, and they put in a Y there and then ran the 900 feet of pipe down to the hydro plant. And so for the first 2 years, that's how we got our electricity, was from that lower diversion dam. But that was only like 250 feet, so we weren't putting out a lot of power because the units were really designed for 640 foot head. And so then the second year, we extended that. There was a logging crew in here for 10 years, and they were actually from Switzerland. We called them the Swiss logging crew because they were from Switzerland. And they used the Skyline process, which was a process of taking a cable, and they strung it up to a tree way up on top of the mountain. And then they also had an engine that they ran up on the cable, and they had the engine up. It was a diesel engine, basically, for braking. And they would pick up the logs, usually three logs at a time, and then they would swing them down on this cable down to the base of the valley, where they would load them onto the logging truck. And the cable was long enough that they could do maybe, I don't know, a couple hundred feet on either side of the cable at once. They would string the cable and pick up logs and slide them down. Anyway, they were the only ones that had any equipment in the village. They had a D4 cat. And so when it came time that we needed to build a road up to the upper diversion dam, we contacted them. And to my knowledge, I think they volunteered their time. They built that road for us at no cost. And we got to be very good friends with them, partially because we had a snack bar. And they loved ice cream. So they would come up, not every evening, but very frequently. They were here. They lived at Lucerne, but they would, you know, drive up here, and we always invited them for programs and Vespers and 4th of July. In fact, one year they had a 4th of July float, and anytime we had trees that needed to be removed for danger trees and so forth, they'd come up and cut them down. I mean, they were just very good friends, and so they actually did the road up to the upper mine level and helped us, you know, establish that. And the idea was that then the 14 inch pipe from what we had installed originally to the top of the diversion dam, it extended it another 2,000 feet, so the total length of the penstock is 2,900 feet, and the dynamic head is 640 feet. And the only thing we had to get, again, we had to build a diversion dam up there, and all of the aggregate and all of the concrete or cement was hauled up in the back of, I think the yellow Jeep is still here, isn't it? Or is it?
No, we wore that one out.
Oh, you did? Oh, no. Did you put it in the museum?
Wasn't any good parts left.
No. But all of the original, you know, the cement and the aggregate and so forth was hauled up in the back of that little Jeep, you know, trip after trip after trip. And the pipe itself, and I think the bomb truck is still here, isn't it?
Yeah. The Arky keeps fixing it.
Pardon?
The Arky keeps fixing it.
Oh, yeah. The same people from Wilbur, Washington that gave us the hydro plants gave us this bomb truck because they said, you know, you don't have any way of even lifting anything up there. We didn't have a crane. We didn't have anything. And this bomb truck, it was an old Army surplus vehicle that had a hoist on it. And then I think we added the what do you call it, the Y?
Boom.
Yeah, boom in front. And these, the 14-inch penstock, they were 40 feet long, and I think each of them weighed 1,000 pounds, if I remember right. So this bomb truck is a four-wheel drive vehicle, so we would take and lift one section of pipe up on the side of the bomb truck and lash it to the truck, and then drive it up the hill and drop it in place. And of course, once it was dropped in place, we didn't have much way of dealing with it, so it had to be, we had to put it right in, and they're put together with dresser couplings, which basically clamp it's their gasket and dresser couplings. And so this whole pipeline, this 2,000 feet of pipeline, was built along the edge of the road. And then And then the Swiss loggers came up when that was done, and then they covered the pipeline and basically made a new road over it. And but you know, it was just amazing, that whole, like the diversion dam and everything was built with volunteers. We didn't, Henry Schwecke, who had 160 acres that his parents' land, I mean, had over across the lake from here. He had worked with Seattle City Light at the Cedar River hydro plant, and he was one of these marvelous guys that didn't say much, but he had a little shop in his basement of his house in Wenatchee that he had lathes, and he could make everything, you know. And so he was the one that contacted us when he found out that we were going to do a hydro plant. We didn't have anybody that had any knowledge of how do you install a hydro plant and how do you, you know, get one going. And he actually was, you know, asked us if he could be involved. And he said, you know, for part of the payment for his services, he would take volunteer labor to help him put in a little hydro plant for his place over in, I think it's Canoe Creek, right across the lake here. So I had a boat, and so I would take four or five of our guys over there, and we would work for the day hauling material for his plant, and then that would take care of some of the cost of his working on our plant. We did pay him some, but it was very, very little. And
Werner?
Yes?
I'm curious how many people were up here when you were doing this kind of project. How many people do you suppose were here?
You mean the workers?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, from right at the beginning, we didn't have any problem finding volunteers. In fact, you know, we were using about 200 or 300 volunteers in the summer, and the minimum was three weeks, and there was really no maximum. But I mean, we weren't open in the winter in the early years, so I mean, there was a maximum because they couldn't stay here. But you know, and so we would get two and three times the number of applications for volunteers. It was a different era during that time when volunteerism was much different than it is now. Nobody can afford to volunteer, or at least for not very long, and so, you know, I would think that all of the volunteers at that time, we had at least 100 most of the time, and then it was, you know, a little bit more on some points of the year. But we never lacked for applications, and that changed in, you know, in the mid-80s. Then, in fact, even before that, fewer and fewer applications came in for volunteer staff, and it was more of a challenge to get staff to come up. And not because they didn't like it here, it's just that volunteerism was changing in the society at that time. So in a sense, Holden began at just the right time in history. I don't think it could begin now. In fact, you know, we often laughed about it, that if somebody would have done a business plan for Holden in the beginning, nobody would have ever gone ahead with it because it just didn't make any sense. So in a very real sense, it was good that you know, like Carol used to say, he said that, you know, God gave the church Holden Village, and then he put a pastor that couldn't stay in a congregation and was kicked out of a number of, at least that's what Carol said. I don't think he was ever kicked out of anything. But anyway, and then he brought in an aeronautical engineer that had never had any experience with business or with running an operation, and that's what God chose to, you know, start Holden. So it didn't make sense right from the beginning. In fact, one of my jobs in those early years during the winter time, you know, I would go around and try to drum up support, both financially and for people to come up here and work. And I would give slide presentations, you know, in churches and in homes. And one time I showed pictures about the hydro project. And after the slide presentation was done, the contractor came up to me and he said, you know, I don't believe you. He said, you couldn't do that job with volunteers. And I said, well, I guess we didn't know that because we did it. And I'm sure that OSHA wouldn't approve most of what we did. But again, in fact, we rightfully credit Wes Priebe with getting Holden Village for, you know, for society and for the church. But But again, it was obvious that, I mean, Wes wasn't an entrepreneur. He wasn't a business person. He didn't have any money. You know, he'd never been here. You know, so that, I mean, Wes rightfully gets the credit for writing the letters, but, you know, it was, you know, there was something else that was at work, a higher power that made it possible for Holden to, you know, to exist. And like I guess I mentioned in my memoirs is that, you know, Wes may have written the letters and God was, you know, had a divine intervention in getting it here, but the only thing we discovered was that God forgot to provide electricity and a bank account and transportation from Lucerne to Holden. So God does marvelous things, but even God didn't think of everything that was needed up here. But going back to the hydro, Henry Schwecke then was the one that engineered the units for us and got it going, and he built a lot of the parts that were missing from the governor. And one of the reasons he was interested in doing this project for us and doing it, you know, at a very low cost was that he had applied to the Schlan PUD to put in the plant up in Stehekin. They were building their plant right at the same time. And Henry was just an individual, and of course the PUD is a large organization, and you know, I don't think Henry had a business license. He was just an individual, but he knew he could do it. But the PUD wouldn't consider his proposal, which was much cheaper than what they ended up doing. And so they turned him down, and so he really wanted to do a project, and it really, the only time I remember seeing Henry smile the way he did was when the word came down from Stehekin that they had the dedication up there, and they threw the switch and it didn't work. About that same time we were finishing this project, and he threw the switch and it worked. And so I think he felt like, you know, it was a great experience, and he was very grateful to Holden Village for allowing him to, you know, be a part of this project. And of course for Holden Village that didn't have any money, it was a lifesaver, because, you know, we couldn't have hired a contractor to do the work. And when we finished the first phase of it, the total cost was $39,000. That was because we were given the units. You know, we had to buy the pipe, we had to pay Henry a little bit, but for that whole first unit, or for the first stage of the project, it was $39,000. And then we added the upper diversion dam and increased the penstock length and so forth. And I can't remember, I think the total price of the project when it was fully operational then was still under $60,000. And I think the project in Stehekin was $250,000. And so that,
What year was it that you completed it?
Well, the first phase was done in August of 1964. And then I think the second phase was in August of 1966. I think that's what it was. And but it was, you know, a great experience. And again, you know, many, many people worked on it, even we had work parties, you know. In fact, one of the first times I came up here was after I had volunteered up here. Then they had a work party in September to hand cover the penstock from in the first phase, and all of that was done by hand. And so you know, there was just a lot of labor, and most of it was not, you know, not trained. I mean, they weren't engineers. They weren't you know, construction people, but fortunately with Henry Schwecke's leadership, and then we did have, you know, like Walt Chesernick from Kennewick, he retired, but he built big projects, and he would come up and make sure that things were being done properly, because you really think with that much pressure on the pipe that, you know, if it wasn't anchored tight enough, the whole thing could have, you know, headed skyward pretty easily. And so it was very well anchored down, probably, you know, more so than it really needed to be. But The project has been going ever since, and of course it's had some revisions, and I think the wheel has been changed on the unit. We changed it once while I was up here, which was an interesting thing in itself, because they were, not pressure fit, but shrink fit, I think is what they call it. And at that point, we had to hire, it was GE out of Spokane that came up and installed the units. And the units were made back east with the Luffel Company, which no longer is in business, but they had been in business for 150 years making Pelton wheels and other hydro units. And they ship dry ice up here. I mean, you know, again, we didn't have a lot of the equipment that GE normally would. They sent two technicians up here to do this, and they packed the shaft in dry ice to decrease the size by a little bit. And, you know, there was really one chance. They had the wheel. I wouldn't even watch it because I was too scared they weren't going to be able to do it. And they had the wheel attached by cables up above, and they had one chance to fit it on and get it in exactly the right place, because the needle valve of the hydro plants, you know, have to be exactly in the buckets, otherwise you're not going to get the efficiency out of the units and so forth. And it worked. I mean, it was a great thing to see. And I don't know, you know, I mean, it was probably one chance out of a thousand that it would work, but it did work. And so I have a picture of the kitchen at that time after the wheel was on. We had a big thank you cake for the two guys from GE, and we had a celebration here in Koinonia, because it was in the off season. And but the cost of electricity for Holden has been, you know, minimal. You know, I mean, you figure how many kilowatt hours of electricity that unit has produced over the years, and even with the money that's been invested in it, you know, in recent years to upgrade it and so forth, the cost has been, you know, I remember that the $39,000 before we got the second phase going on it, that I calculated how much it was costing us per kilowatt hour at that point, and it was a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour or something. It was very, very minimal. And when Holden first started, we actually contacted the Chelan County PUD and said, because the power lines were still up here from the mining days. They ran up on the I guess it would be the north side of the lake, and then they crossed the lake at about Domke Lake, and then they came up the valley, and they were huge lines. I think it was 5 steel and 2 copper, if I remember right. They finally sold the salvage rights, and a salvage company came in to take the power lines down. But we thought, I mean, the first choice was to activate those lines. And the PUD, of course, they had no guarantee that, nobody thought we would last. So, I mean, the PUD wasn't going to front fund, you know, because all of the distribution station was taken down from the mine, the transformers, the switches and everything was taken down after the mine left. So all of that would have had to been redone. And then the PUD said that you would be paying for, it would be metered in Manson, and then we would pay for any line loss that occurred between there and here. And of course, we would be responsible for any maintenance on the lines. They weren't going to, I mean, it wasn't a PUD line. So, I mean, it just wasn't practical. I think they said that they would activate them for $100,000. And of course, we were talking, and Chuck mentioned the same thing. He said if that hydro plant wouldn't be there, that, you know, Holden may not have lasted this long, because just the cost of electricity, you know, from either diesel or if we would have gone with the PUD, they would have bankrupted us. There was just no way that we could pay for that. So the hydro plant is, you know, is really, you know, one of the gifts that, again, volunteers have given to make Holden a possibility. And so it was a marvelous project, again, it's hard to imagine that we could do it, but fortunately it worked, and it's still working, except it's not going now. So it will be soon.
It's just resting.
Yeah, right, it's resting. It needs a rest after Because it was, well, see, in 64, so that was 50 years ago that we started using it. And it was 20 years, it sat in a warehouse for 20 years, and I don't know how many years prior to that that had been used. So, you know, but like Henry said, and even when the GE came up and we're helping with it, they said, you know, they don't make generators like this anymore. I mean, there was so much metal, and it was built so heavily that otherwise maybe it wouldn't have lasted. But it was, they're good units, and at some point maybe they won't last. But it's been a real gift. Another one of the big projects that we did was the dock that you all came in on down at Lucerne. And when the Swiss loggers were done with their operation, it was in 1969, in the fall of 1969, and I never did find out for certainly how this worked, but my speculation was that the Swiss loggers had like a half a year left on their contract in the valley, and they didn't want to come up here for just a half of season because of the cost of getting equipment up here and so forth. And the contract that they had with the Forest Service indicated that there would be a penalty if they didn't finish the logging contract. And my speculation, and it's strictly my speculation, that the Forest Service said, we'll make you a deal. If you burn down the dock, and then there was a dock house down right in front of the, you know, where the little A-frame is down there now, that the waiting station, right on the lakeside of that was a beautiful little chalet. It was just a small version of the chalets that are up here now, and that's where the dockman lived during the mining days, because they unloaded they took the ore in big, I think they were 15-ton vats, or no, 7-ton vats, I think. And there were 3 7-ton vats that they took down in a truck, and then they unloaded them from the truck and put them on the barge, and then hauled them down to Chelan, and then they, in Chelan, they actually dumped these vats into a truck, which was then trucked down to Chelan Falls and loaded into rail cars, and then it was taken over to the smelter in Tacoma, the Asarco? Yeah, which isn't there anymore. But, I mean, to imagine that they could even make any money off of the ore, which was a low-grade ore, after doing all of that, but they did. And but anyway, this dock house was there, and I think the Forest Service wanted to get rid of that for some reason. And the old dock was, I mean, it was, the floating section didn't work anymore, and it was in poor shape. The old big hoist, or the unit that it was on rail tracks on the dock, and that's how they unloaded the vats. And you know, and it wasn't working anymore, but it was still sitting there. And the Forest Service, I think, made a deal with the loggers that said, you know, you burn the dock down and get rid of it, and you burn your house down, because the Swiss loggers had told us when they're done, they would give us that house. And the dock was actually Holden's, but that we had sort of sold the rights to use to the logging company for $2,500, I think, with the idea that it would come back to Holden. Anyway, for whatever reason, it was burned down. The dock was burned down. The house was burned down. And, you know, I contacted the Forest Service, and I said, what's the plan for rebuilding the dock? This is our only way that we can get people up here. And they said, well, we really don't have any plans. It might take 2-3 years. I mean, we don't have any money now, but it might take 2 or 3 years for us to get money. And I said, well, what are we supposed to do? They said, well, you know, just unload people on the rocks. And Oscar Getty had an old dock in front of his place. And that, during the summers, that's actually what we ended up using. The boat would come in and nose up to the dock, and people would unload there. And then we would have the buses pick up people there and bring them up here. And so, we were mad at the Forest Service, but they are our landlords, so you couldn't get too mad at them, because they had all the, they made all the rules. And there was a doctor from Port Angeles the winter in January and December of 1969 that brought a youth group up from his church in Port Angeles. And he chartered a boat to bring the kids up here, and I think he brought, you know, like 20 or 25 young people from their church for a winter experience. And he got to Lucerne, and there was no dock there, and they had to unload at Refrigerator Harbor, and he was really mad, and I guess we had forgotten to tell him there was no dock, or somehow. Anyway, when he got up here, he said, you know, what are you guys doing? You know, aren't you putting pressure on the Forest Service to build a new dock? And, you know, I sort of told him, well, you know, they're our landlords, and we don't want to make them mad, but we've, you know, asked about it, and we've encouraged him. And he said, well, do you mind if I write a letter? He was, I think his partner in the medical practice in Port Angeles was the state campaign chairman for either Magnus or Jackson at that time, who were both they were very powerful in Congress, and so we told him, yeah, I mean, yeah, if you want to do that, that's fine. We can't stop you from doing it. So he did. He, you know, on his letterhead, medical letterhead, he wrote this letter to, I think it was Magnuson, and of course he got a letter back right away, you know, from Magnuson, and said that, yeah, I mean, that's a serious situation, and I'll look into it, and I'll talk to the Secretary of the Agriculture and see if I can't get something going. And we thought at first that things were going to get going. We heard from the Forest Service, and they said, okay, we've heard from, you know, the Secretary of Agriculture, and apparently, you know, there's some pressure from somebody that we need to get that dock done. And, you know, and then a month later, we got another letter from the Forest Service, and they said, well, it's all off. That I think it was during the Nixon administration, and the whole Forest Service budget had been cut by 50% or something. It was a large amount. And so they said, no money available. You can't do anything. And the doctor from Port Angeles, I just can't think of his name right offhand. Anyway, he said, well, you know, the one thing you could do would be maybe you could start a letter-writing campaign. And, you know, and I thought that sounded like a pretty good idea. So, you know, and he suggested that, you know, it might do most good if you can contact people that have been to Holden that have some title in front of their name, like a doctor or an attorney or, you know, somebody that might have some power in a sense. And so we did. I went through the whole mailing list, and I think at that point, you know, out of the 50 states, we probably had people here from at least 40 or 45 states. And so that I picked out names, you know, college professors, attorneys, you know, doctors, and we wrote to them and asked them to write to their individual congresspeople. So that the word would get not only from the state of Washington, but all over the nation. And, you know, and then we were sort of worried, you know, what is the Forest Service going to say when we did this? And, you know, and I finally told the district ranger, I said what we were going to do and that, you know, we didn't want to cause any problems for them, but it was a serious situation for us. And it turned out that I got the district ranger said, you know, we can't officially do this, but if you bring down a sample of a letter, I'll have two of my secretaries in the district ranger's office help type these letters on your letterhead. So they were all for us. I mean, they thought it was, and so that all of these letters started going to various, you know, senators and representatives in the whole United States, and it started having an effect. And during the winter at that time, this was our winter building. We ate, and we had folding tables that we put out here for, you know, our meals, and right at the end of where the library is now is a small kitchen, and so this was our winter activity. And we were eating breakfast one Saturday morning. It was I think it was in February, and we heard a plane go rather low over the village, and you know, we didn't pay much attention to it initially, but it kept going back and forth, and so we went outside, and of course there was, you know, 6 feet of snow on the ground and so forth. And then we noticed that it was Ernie Gibson's plane. He was the float, he was the pilot that had the float plane business on the lake for like 40 years and, you know, solved all problems of transportation for people. And anyway, he kept flying back and forth. And then when he noticed that we were out there, we noticed that he dropped something out of the cockpit that had a long, you know, Day-Glo ribbon on it. And it landed down here below Koinonia in the, fortunately it didn't land in the creek, but we found it. And it was a container that had a message in it that said the Forest Service wants me to go down to Lucerne by 11 o'clock that morning and for a meeting. And that they had gotten word that, you know, the government now said that this dock had to be built and it had to be built now. And so I took the snowmobile and went down to Lucerne and met the Forest Service, and they said that we need to decide where this dock is going to go, and if we don't get it built this spring, we're going to be in trouble. And they said, and the only problem is that we've got a real time crunch because the lake was down on its minimum, you know, at that time of year. But starting in like April, when the thaw starts, the lake starts coming up. And the cribbing for the dock, you know, along the bank, I mean, it's between the, I don't know how to describe it. Anyway, there was cribbing that had to be put in at the low water. And if we missed that window, then the whole project would have to be delayed until the next year. And the Forest Service said, you know, I don't think we can do this, that, you know, we've got pressure on us to get it done. And anything that we do, you know, like with the treated timbers and so forth, and with even the galvanized bolts and so forth, they had to be done by government specifications. And he said, by law, we have to send this out for bid. And, you know, there's no way that we can get this done. And I said, well, you know, how much is it going to cost just to order that material? And it wasn't that much. It was, I think, $5,000 or something. And so I said, what if we pay for, you know, that material, because Holden doesn't have to go out to bid. You just give me the list of specifications, and I'll come down what was the, there was an outfit across, was it in Winslow, where they had that plant where they made treated timbers and so forth. I can't remember the...
Eagle Harbor.
Yeah, and anyway, the Forest Service gave me the specifications and told me who handled this material, like the treated timbers and you know, the galvanized bolts and so forth. And they said, now you can't make the call from the Forest Service. That would be too risky. But so I went down, and at that time we actually had a little office that we had. And so I sat down and I called the treated timber people, and I said, you know, we need to order this, and this is what we need. And they said, well, is this a bid item? And I said, nope, ship it tomorrow, you know. you've been chosen. And the same way with the galvanized hardware that was needed to build the stuff. And we ordered that. And so that came within a, you know, a short time. And they were able to get that part of it done before the water came up. And then the boat company, it turned out to be a project between the boat company, the Forest Service, and Holden Village. The boat company agreed to drive the piling at no cost. I mean, the Forest Service supplied the piling, but they would put it in at no cost. And then Holden agreed to provide as much volunteer labor as we could to help, you know, build this dock. And we happened to have a fellow on the volunteer staff that summer that again had been a supervisor in large construction projects. So he was the lead person that worked with the volunteers. So it turned out to be, oh, and one other thing was that Oscar Getty, who, you know, lived down there, and he had a lifelong battle with the Forest Service, because the Forest Service always wanted to buy his 3 acres and he refused to sell it, and they still haven't sold it to him. And he had this old cabin that he lived in that, you know, wasn't well painted, and they told him one time that they would really like to have him paint, you know, painted in sort of Forest Service gray or brown, and so he painted yellow, and bright yellow, and And he came up to me when he found out that we were going to cooperate at putting in this new dock. And he says, you know, don't tell the Forest Service, but he gave me a check for $2,500. And he said, I want to help do this, but I don't want the Forest Service to know that I'm helping with it. And so the $2,500 added to another $2,500 that Holden put into it was enough to pay for this initial material. And then during that next summer, the rest of the dock was built and put in. But again, it was sort of an interesting story. And now, I mean, when the new museum goes up, I gave Larry Howard, who's doing the museum, I had saved all these letters, because after all these letters went to congressmen and, you know, we would get copies of them here. And, you know, I got a copy from the Secretary of Agriculture, and I can't remember, I mean, some pretty high political people and a lot of senators, a lot of representatives. And it was, you know, not a bound volume, but I had it in a binder. And, I mean, it makes great reading to see, you know, all the people that you'd recognize, the Mondales, I can't remember, of course, the Jackson and Magnuson and, you know, people that were great people in the government at that time that all got involved in this project and, you know, said that we think this dock ought to get built and, you know, we'll make sure that we contact the Secretary of Agriculture It was a great experience that fortunately the Forest Service also thought was a good, and they helped us do it. I mean, the local ranger station realized that a mistake had been made, and so they were great. They were really happy that the project went forward. So it, instead of, you know, taking 4 or 5 years for a dock to be built, it was done in, you know, a very short time. And but it was like, you know, it proves that a nonprofit operation that doesn't have any money up in the mountains that nobody knows about could, in a sense, influence the, you know, our government. So it was a great thing to experience and be involved in that whole process. I think last night I mentioned a little bit about the Lucerne development, and even though that didn't go through, it was still a good experience to involve a lot of people. And we did a lot of little projects up here. I mentioned about Leo Bustedt, who was with the School of Veterinary Medicine at WSU, and he was one of his passions, life passions, was to get people pets into nursing homes and into hospitals. You know, at that time, in those years, it was against the law to take a pet into a nursing home or a hospital. And he was convinced that it was part of the healing process and they should be able to, you know, have pets. And now they do. And he was involved in writing the law that was passed by the government. In fact, he was invited to the White House when the bill was signed that then made it possible for pets to be into nursing homes and hospitals. But one of the ideas that he had was that he was always trying to think of how, you know, animals, pets could be enjoyed by people. And he had this idea that racing pigeons, homing pigeons, you know, disappeared, but there were still racing pigeons. And he said, you know, I think Holden ought to have some pigeons up there. And he says, I've got a friend that raises them. He said, you know, would you mind having a little project up there? And so the first one, in fact, the first place where we had the pigeons was in the old garage at Chalet 1. I think that's still there. And it's done many things over the years, but it was the first pigeon coop. And he brought up an egg, several eggs, as well as several baby pigeons, because nobody was really sure. Some theories was that the pigeons have to be born at the place where they return, and then others said that they had to be young when they were growing up. So we had both the egg and the baby pigeons, and then I think the A-frame is still up there, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably just storage in it. But then when we outgrew the garage down here and wanted to make it more secure, and we ended up with about 30 pigeons, and we had this A-frame set up back here, and we thought we had it really secure, and it was a great project because, I mean, they were beautiful to watch, that you would release the pigeons. We always did it right at coffee break time when everybody was gathered up there, and you wouldn't feed the pigeons before their exercise flights. You'd let them out of the cage and all 30 of them would take off and do this beautiful flight, you know, overhead, and they would sort of fly formation, and then you would put the feed out and they would all, you know, fly back to the pen. So after, you know, 4 or 5 months of this, with the boat that I had on the lake, and I would go down for business trips, and I would take a cage with 3 or 4 pigeons, and we didn't know whether they'd come back or what, so that it was sort of an unknown thing when we first did it. But I would get down to 25 Mile Creek, and then I would note the time, and I would write the time down, and then let the pigeons loose. And the first time I did that, I thought, oh no, this isn't going to work, because I just assumed they would go back up the lake. And they did they always do 3 loops. When they come out of the cage, they do 3 loops and then they head home. And they headed over 25 Mile Creek, sort of in the northwest direction, over land. And I thought, no, there's no way that they're going to get back. And then when I got back up to the village, because I was gone all day, and I got back up in the afternoon, and there were a couple of the staff that were sort of waiting for them, and I said, did the pigeons ever return? And they said, oh yeah, they got here at such and such a time, and it was like 30 minutes from the time I released them until the pigeons got here. And we did that, you know, numerous times. And at first we would just take them down like to 10 Mile and they would fly back. And then we took them down to Lucerne and they would fly back. And then, you know, took them down to 25 Mile. And I mean, it was so much fun to, you know, watch them head out, and you know, they always made it back here. But that Christmas, after we had, you know, raised them for, you know, 6 months or more, a weasel got into the cage and just very quickly killed all 30 pigeons. I mean, it was you know, there was no way. We thought we had the A-frame tightly secured, but we apparently didn't. And then we decided that, you know, there was just no way up here that, you know, we could deal with nature. So that was the end of the pigeon project. So, I don't know, there's not much time, but if any of you have any questions or anything that, but it's always fun to talk about these things. And, you know, some of these projects, in a sense, didn't make any sense, but they were all part of somebody's idea, and they were fun to do, and it was an educational thing. I mean, things like the dock and the hydro plant were, you know, a real critical thing for Holden, but a lot of the other things that we did up here, you know, was mainly for education and for fun, so, yeah.
So, Werner, last night you mentioned that you bought a still for the Jerusalem artichokes. What happened to that still?
Pardon?
What happened to the still?
Oh, well, actually, I bought it, and I, because when I left, the still had just arrived, and it was still in its crate, and it was, I think, I don't know, 5 years later, I contacted the village and asked if, you know, they were going to do anything with the still or if it was here, and they said they didn't know whether it was here anymore, but I got a letter then and said that they found it, and it was still in its crate, and it was up on the upper mine level in the junk pile or something. I can't remember, but I mean, this brand new, you know, 25-gallon still, it was beautiful, you know. And so I said, well, you know, because I really wanted to do something in Leavenworth, and I did buy an old VW, and because that was the easiest to transfer, I mean, to redo into ethanol alcohol. At least that's what I read in Mother Earth News or one of those engineering manuals. And I actually had the VW running on ethanol alcohol that I just bought by the gallon, but it was $10 a gallon when you bought it, so it wasn't practical to run it that way. But I never did get the still, you know, I didn't make use of it because it was an electric still, and even though the electricity in Chelan County is only $0.03 a kilowatt hour, it still was expensive to do, and so I ended up giving it away to somebody who, you know, was going to use it for a project, but it was too bad. That it would have been fun if that could have been implemented up here, and if we could have actually produced alcohol from the Jerusalem artichokes and run, you know, the garbage truck or, you know, some of the other, and then Terry could have had fun with ethanol alcohol. But thank you very much. It's been fun to share.
Thank you.